Happy New Year to you. It's great to be back here in 2023. Not that we really took much of a break. I just spoke to you last week, but it's good to be in the new year. Hope you had a good holiday season. It's been a busy start to the new year, and it's a particularly a rocky one in the House of Representatives. House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy had a lot of trouble this week getting the votes he needed to become House Speaker. On multiple ballots, McCarthy failed to reach the magic number of 218, which, if you're familiar with how the House of Representatives works, they need that 218. That's the majority number that you need to pass legislation to basically get any type of major action done in the House. You have to have a majority. And that's the same thing in the Speaker's race, where you have to have the magic number of 218 members. Now, the Republicans only have 222. So he can only afford to lose four people and still make it across the finish line and grab the Speaker's gavel. You can imagine the tight rope that he's trying to walk here. And McCarthy is trying to deal with concessions to people on the more conservative side of the caucus while trying to keep the moderates in line as well. So McCarthy's been having to deal with that. Multiple ballots, which is the first time that a speaker's race has gone to more than one ballot in the House of Representatives in over 100 years. And at this point, we're talking about something that we haven't seen in 160 years as we've crossed the 9-ballot threshold. So this has been a busy start in the political universe for 2023. Some may have not expected it, while others, they might have saw it coming. But we have a whole panel on that this week. We have Rutgers political science and law professor Joe Leo Carney Warden and former Rutgers Democrats member Toby Amatoso. They're going to be joining us later in the show to break this all down. And what does it mean for you and the House of Representatives going forward? In particular, the GOP. They still got two more years to go here. And this, nothing can start in the House of Representatives until they pick a speaker. So everything's essentially frozen. All the oversight investigations into Biden, any possible actions of trying to impeach any Biden administration officials, that all can't happen until they pick a speaker. So a lot of battles ahead for the GOP family feud. So we'll be watching that for sure. But we got to get to this story because what normally would be Republicans doing a happy dance or in a way they're getting their way on issue, maybe they're not paying attention to as much as usual. President Biden plans to visit the southern border for the first time since he has taken office. The president will be heading down to El Paso, Texas on Sunday. He made the announcement at the White House yesterday. Biden says he's going, quote, to assess border enforcement operations, meet with the local officials and community leaders and the folks at the border, sending me what they need that they don't have, close quote. This comes after he's faced immense criticism for not going to the border up till this point. Republicans in general have made a big talking point. It was something they ran heavily on in the midterms. And now Biden's kind of trying to flip the issue on them. And there's a lot to discuss here for sure. The first thing we have to talk about is now he's making it a policy issue. As you recall, all 2021 and a good part of 2022, Biden really did not want to talk about this issue at all. And then he started pushing for the end of Title 42, which is the provision that essentially during a public health emergency that the United States can deny entrance of anyone into the country for public health reasons, being COVID. So they're using the COVID pandemic as the reasoning behind that. This was done in March of 2020 during the Trump administration and the Biden administration. Like, nope, we don't want to do that anymore. The pandemic is over. But people have warned if Title 42 is removed, then the border could essentially become out of hand. And there's been a lot of criticism of how Biden has handled it. Republicans have hammered him on that. Well, Democrats have said, hey, listen, we need to have a immigration reform, but we need to have a system that is more charitable to these immigrants and migrants who are making the journey. So you have that dynamic at play here. And Biden's trying to turn the issue on his head, basically saying that the Republicans, they're not serious about this at all. That's what he was saying yesterday at that White House. They're not serious about this at all. They just want to make it a political issue. I'm willing to work with the Republicans on this. This is basically what he's trying to lay the groundwork. He's trying to lay out this, I'm going to work on this. I'm going to be the problem solver guy. Now, you're probably saying to yourself, why is Biden making the move now? Well, there's a couple reasons. And one is a political one for sure. And that is that he is running for re-election. Now, has it been confirmed? No. But a lot of people in the media are expecting to make this announcement because, as I mentioned a week or two on the show, his wife, Dr. Jill Biden, the First Lady, is all in on the idea. So he's got her support, and a lot of the time when he's had her support in the past, he tends to follow through on these things. So with that expectation, he's going to have to deal with some issues on the table. One, he's got to be seen as more of that problem-solving Joe that he pitched himself as during the election, and we may have not necessarily seen during his time in the White House, particularly his inability to work with Republicans on certain issues, as well as aligning himself with very progressive parts of the Democratic Party to get certain pieces of legislation through, which some would argue may not be the most moderate thing. So he has to do that. Also, he's got to get ahead of the problem. And it is showing in the polling that his approval rating with handling the border, it's just not pretty. It's in the 30s. And there has been issues at the border. We have seen record numbers of known gotaways and border crossings and all these things that do not look favorable for Biden. So Biden's got to clamp this down. If Biden wants to have a good re-election campaign, and also in Arizona and Nevada, some border states, and if he needs to be a little competitive in Texas, and as you're seeing in Florida, where he's looking to send back Cuban migrants, these are things that Biden has to be competitive on, one, to get the electoral math to work out in the electoral college, and two, if he wants to possibly regain a majority in the House, a lot of these districts sit right on that southern border. And if they're getting overrun by migrants, that might be a problem for him. And then also the fact that a lot of these migrants are making their way up the coast and are being bused to places like New York City, where these are heavily Democratic coalitions, but if they start feeling the problem, they might not be so as inclined to vote for Joe Biden, which would also essentially be a problem on the congressional map. So he's got that dynamic at play, and he has to deal with the problem. He's got to look like he is solving the problem, and that if he gets reelected, then he can deal with it. Also, the border is just not a good look for him, like I said, because of all these new numbers that we've been getting out the last, I'd say 3 months, ever since October, we've really been getting that, since we've really changed to the fiscal year 2023. And that the 2022 fiscal year numbers were about the highest it's ever been. These are things that Biden is now having to come to terms with, and he's got to get ahead of it. Otherwise, the Republicans are just going to make his life more miserable, and his approval rating is going to go down further. So he's got that. Now, why now? Yes, we do have the numbers. He is maybe going to announce soon. That's what we keep hearing. So maybe January, February, we're going to get a little glimpse of what his future holds. But also, we have to deal with the fact that he has to look like more the moderate problem-solving alternative to Republicans here. That's also a playing factor here, is this whole Kevin McCarthy drama. That now that that's in play, politically, the Democrats have an opportunity, if they play this right, to look like the stable party, the reliable party, the ones who can get the job done that aren't drama and that are going to have stability in the country. They're going to make America look strong to its allies on the international stage. So Biden has to capitalize on that now. And what a better way to do it than to bring up the border issue now, to go down there, something that is very important to Republicans, say, hey guys, listen, I'm ready to work on this. I toured it. I know what needs to be done. Let's get a deal done here. While the Republicans at the moment here look like they're in a little bit of a scramble. And Biden can present himself as that, then it puts the Republicans on defense now, because Biden's been on defense up to this point on the issue. The Republicans, what they were doing, they had to hammer him on this in order to get some traction. Hammer, 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 Biden, border, border, bad, bad, bad. And now Biden's trying to flip the table here, saying, guys, I want to do something. You need to work with me here. And the Republicans don't. That could be a problem. That could be a problem for them, because then it looks like they're not really governing. They're just there to block anything that he does. It doesn't even matter if it's even relevant to their cause. So Biden has to look like he's willing to do bipartisan things. Otherwise, independents may tune out on this guy. Now, if you're the Republicans, you gotta play this just right. Obviously, you gotta fight for the border cause because your base really cares about it. So you gotta go a little way. But you don't want to give it all away either. You have to find a hole. You gotta dig some holes there. And specifically, go to the Title 42 part, because he's still not a fan of that. They're still trying to fight down that in court. So then you gotta play up that argument. Be like, hey, yeah, he wants to do this, but at the same time, he wants to get rid of Title 42 without any real plan. But again, you got to be careful, because if Biden does end up coming with some type of border security plan that meets their platform, then the argument's going to be made by the Democrats, what do you need Title 42 for? We got this plan right here. So the Republicans got to walk the fine line there too. Now, one final point, again, is going back to the timeline. Why would Biden bring this up now? Well, there is another line of thinking. Maybe he knows he has to deal with the issue, but he also doesn't want his base paying attention to this, because the Democratic base largely wants to focus more on the citizenship issue of this, not so much the border security aspect. And if they start seeing him talk about deportations and putting money towards a quote-unquote border wall, or border security agents, that might not be a great look for him. So he's kind of doing it under the gun while the progressives are salivating over the GOP family feud in the House. He can just slip it on in casually and nobody will know the difference. But he can tout it in certain areas along the border that he is in fact doing something. So it could be a political strategy that way. He knows he's got to do something here, but he doesn't necessarily want everyone in the world finding out. So he's kind of doing it under the gun, especially on Sunday, where things are just going to be, you know, people aren't going to really be paying attention because it's a Sunday. Yeah, people, obviously the new channels are going to run it, but a lot of people, they're watching football or going to church, that type of stuff. You got your Sunday things going on. Now, obviously, football, that's a whole story in itself going on with Damal Hamlin, which, by the way, prayers to DeMar Hamlin and the Buffalo Bills and the families there. It's truly an awful thing what that guy's got to go through, but hopefully he pulls through for sure on that. But in regards to the timing of Biden, this is just clearly, it's possible that this could be the thinking behind that. And the Republicans, if they want to play it right too, get their act together with Stop the Family Feud and go back to this border issue and really hammer it and maybe hold the Biden administration accountable, because as you know, Kevin McCarthy has floated possibly impeaching Alejandro Mayorkas, the DHS secretary, if they don't find it very satisfactory, his job, what he's been doing. So that's the whole deal with Biden, and we're going to be watching very closely on Sunday to see how both sides respond to this and what the president says and proposes on how he wants to handle the situation going forward. Now, here's what we're getting in the middle of this week. Well, we have some history that's being made in Washington. It's a crazy week it's been down there in D.C. On the Senate side, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell is now the longest serving Republican leader in Senate history. And he had his conference strongly behind him in that vote. On the House side, well, it's historic, but for a much different reason. For the first time in over 100 years, a House Speaker nominee has failed to win a majority on the first ballot. Now, the last time this kind of happened was in 1923 when it took 9 ballots to elect a speaker. But now we've gone beyond that point on multiple ballots here. And that happened yesterday when we are on the 10th ballot. And now we're heading to territory where the 1800s. That's about where the last time we saw something like this. And it's an interesting thing, because in these ballots we've saw multiple times where there were 19 opponents of McCarthy on the Republican side, then 20. Then we had Victoria Sparks. Basically, she voted present. So McCarthy struggled this week to get those people across the finish line in the first couple of days of doing this. And the whole thing is raising concerns over the GOP's ability to govern, considering Kevin McCarthy was the leader of this conference for 4 straight years, ever since Paul Ryan announced he wasn't seeking re-election and the Democrats got the House and Pelosi got the gavel, but Kevin McCarthy was in charge of the House Republicans. And he was up for this job a few years back, 2015, but he failed to get the votes then. He pulled out before he even got to the floor. And now we're seeing what may have possibly played out years ago, had McCarthy vowed to continue on his quest for the speakership. So what does this all mean for the Republicans going forward in the House and as well as government over the next 2 years? Well, joining me now is Rutgers political science and law professor Joe Leo Carney Waterman and former Rutgers Democrats member Toby Amatoso. Gentlemen, thank you both so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Joey. I appreciate it.
Pleasure to be here, Joey.
So let's talk about this opposition. The opposition to Kevin McCarthy is overwhelmingly conservative, but its makeup isn't the traditional group of members who have opposed him in the past. A lot of the Freedom Caucus and the MAGA crowd are firmly in McCarthy's corner. Toby, what conclusions should we draw about the makeup of this opposition?
I think that, I mean, I obviously oppose a lot of what Kevin McCarthy believes in, but I think what he's actually dealing with is the kind of complicated and fractured state of American politics at the moment. You've got some Tea Party holdouts from back in the day in the caucus. You've got some very clearly MAGA supporters in this group, and some are just kind of like old guard who don't believe that that Congress has been working properly. Like Chip Roy, definitely a supporter of Donald Trump, but also has had moderate positions in the past. You know, it kind of just seems like there's just not a clear forward direction of the party, and everyone's being pretty hard on Kevin McCarthy for that resulting complexity that was reflected in the midterm elections. You know, some people want to go all full speed ahead on a lot of the Trumpier parts of the Republican agenda, but other parts would prefer a more establishment type lean, and nobody's happy, and so they're taking it out on Kevin McCarthy.
Now, there are members on the same part of the ideological spectrum who are on different sides of this. You have Lauren Boebert, who's in the Never Kevin crowd. Basically, she says she's really never going to vote for Kevin McCarthy, although some people believe they might be able to push her. And then you got the other side with Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's backing McCarthy. Professor, what does this say about the opposition?
Well, what it says about the opposition, if you take the cynical approach, and this is, of course, based on reporting that you have reporting out of Politico and Axios, and hasn't really been denied by a number of the members of that faction, is that there's quite a bit of personal wheeling and dealing going on. So what you have is Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has openly admitted that she will not be on a committee, and that's for reasons having to do with the previous Congress. She's not going to be sitting on a committee, so she has no personal stake in opposing a Speaker McCarthy position. Individuals like Matt Gaetz from Florida, Dan Bishop, and Lauren Boebert are all looking for committee positions, if you believe the story is going on behind the scenes. And they are holding out until Kevin McCarthy essentially assigns them not simply to any committee, but there are choice committees on which they want to serve. That has been untenable to would-be Speaker McCarthy because there is a ranking order. There is the idea that you have to put in your dues and that you need to know how these committees work. It's not simply a desire to serve on them. There are individuals who have seniority on the House side who have waited their turn, they bided their time, and now they expect to be placed in those rather coveted positions on some of the more prominent House committees. And so what I believe is happening is that you have a number of that faction who truly and sincerely are doing it out of a sense of self-dealing. And then there are members of that faction who I truly do believe sincerely, authentically, Chip Roy is an example of one, Representative Roy from Texas, who honestly have become fed up with business as usual. And I hope that at some point, Joey, we will have an opportunity to walk your listening audience through the timeline of how we got here, because it didn't just start a few days ago. This actually started in 2012, more than 10 years ago. And if we understand the evolution of the Tea Party and what they have been demanding of the so-called establishment of the GOP, this particular moment, particularly represented by individuals like Representative Chip Roy, is not at all shocking or surprising.
Now, the Never McCarthy group has put up multiple alternatives, including Jim Jordan and Byron Donalds. Toby, what do you make of the names being put forth by the opposition?
It's kind of hard to tell. I mean, Jim Jordan being nominated, Jim Jordan voted for McCarthy be the speaker. And so you kind of have to wonder why members of his caucus are doing that. But I would deign to guess that it's just kind of a name that they are comfortable putting themselves behind to represent a no vote against McCarthy. I mean, you saw Matt Gaetz, he voted for Trump, who's not, I mean, as we all know, a member of Congress, but it's which is okay. You can do that for House Speaker votes. But I think it's really just affiliating names. I am interested to see Byron Donalds, that he's being named. I'm wondering if that means that he's a rising star in the party. I mean, he's been around for like about, I think, a few terms now, but not very long. So he's definitely on the Freedom Caucus Trump side of things. So it could be a sign that he's a rising star. But again, I get the sense that this is, as Professor Waterton mentioned, that it's a combination of people being aggrieved about personal matters with Kevin McCarthy, aggrieved about committee positions, and then also people who just don't like the way that the party has conducted business in general. And that's why the gains during the midterms weren't what they expected. They think that they can find something better somewhere and somewhere else. And they've just kind of decided that any alternative is better than the status quo. And they're sending that message with those votes.
Professor, I want to specifically talk about Byron Donalds, because his development's kind of interesting. He was originally on the McCarthy side, then someone threw his name into contention, then it seems like behind the scenes they kind of got to him, then he was like, oh, well, I'm not on the McCarthy train anymore, now I'm gonna be my own thing, and even though I don't really want the job, I'm gonna run for it anyways. It just keeps changing the person the opposition wants to go with, and they have promised some anonymous candidate multiple times that was going to come along and stroll on in, and that was going to somehow garner the support of a majority of the Republican conference, and that just simply hasn't happened. Why does their choice for speaker keep changing?
Well, because this isn't truly about the choice of a speaker. This is about changing the rules of how the House operates. I saw it, I heard it, particularly the anger and frustration in the voice of Representative Chip Roy when the omnibus bill was working its way through the House. You can even hear it in the way that Representative Byron Donald responded to Representative Waltz from Florida and his suggestion that, individuals are going to eventually start talking about working with Democrats. And just as an aside, Joey, it doesn't need to happen that way. You reference Victoria Sparks and the fact that she voted present. For the benefit of your listeners, the number of individuals that vote present reduces the threshold by which Kevin McCarthy has to actually overcome. So by her voting present, she reduced the requirement from 218 now down to 217. And what many people believe is eventually going to happen, although so far Democrats have held it together, I don't know that it will last much longer, is that eventually Democrats are going to be exhausted as well. There's going to come a point where some members want to go home, and essentially they will have to vote present as well, or not be present. But anyway, the point is that these members are looking to change the rules. I read through at least 15 concessions that would-be Speaker McCarthy has granted in the past 24 to 48 hours. My understanding is that much of that has to do with President Trump on the other end basically saying, give that to them, give that to them. And so they are looking to see maximum extraction. The problem is I think there's going to come a point at which the Chip Roys of the party are going to be satisfied with the concessions. And I believe that the individuals who are striving for more personal aggrandizement, more personal ascension, the Lauren Boberts, I believe they are going to continue to hold out until they get those prime positions. And I have said it before, and I'll say it again. I believe that Representative Boebert took a look at the ascension of Representative Elise Stefanik to be the replacement for former Representative Liz Cheney. And I think that grieved her a bit. So she's looking for her come up as well. And so all of these things are in play, but even the nominating of President Trump. Remember that you don't have to be a member of the House to be speaker. You can be nominated outside of that. And so even the choice to do that, I think, was Representative Gates's acknowledgement that, you know, that said, even though he could very well be, President Trump has absolutely no intention whatsoever of taking over the House. Well, I shouldn't say that. Who knows? But it's very unlikely that that's where he would be headed. But all of these are simply to fill the role, to say someone's name on the record until we get maximum extraction of concessions from a would-be Speaker McCarthy. And I think the biggest one that they earned, which was a surprise to me, the biggest they earned was would-be Speaker McCarthy's agreement that the Club for Growth and the National Republican Congressional Campaign Committee would no longer be able to put their thumb on the scales in safe, open primary, in safe, open districts. So where there is a Republican who is seeking re-election in the primary and that seat is considered to be safe, what you've seen in the past is the Club for Growth would stand behind the allegedly more moderate candidate to the disadvantage of the Tea Party or populist conservative candidate. Oh. And now what they have gotten Speaker McCarthy to say, which he did not do in just this past midterm election, is they've got him to pledge that that will no longer happen. That was a major extraction. I thought maybe that would end things, but apparently there's more to be had.
Professor, if I may ask,
sure.
Are you saying, when you mentioned that this goes back to 2012, is it more that the dreams of 2012 Tea Party conservatives were not realized, or is it that there's a level of instability in the party since then that has not been properly clamped down on?
No. What I mean by that is that the Tea Party, the misconception of a number of the members of my former party is that the Tea Party arose in opposition to President Obama. That simply was the largest rallying cry. But remember that the Tea Party rose as a result of what they considered to be out of control spending that they attributed to President Obama, but they also attributed that to Republicans in the establishment. And many of them took aim at what they considered to be Bush Republicans. That's when you first heard this term arise, Bush Republicans in the establishment. And they were frustrated because the Iraq War was being held as an albatross about their neck, and they rose up. Now, remember who the three principal, who some of the three of the biggest names coming out of the Tea Party movement, interestingly enough, was former Representative Eric Cantor.
Yep.
And former Representative Paul Ryan, who no one in the Freedom Caucus today considers to be a Tea Party conservative, and Kevin McCarthy. And so these were three of the most notable names coming out of that movement. The problem is that every single year they have been told, play along to get along, play along to get along. And they've consistently seen their request for fiscal responsibility and the like to be heeded. And what have they done? Tonight, they had enough. And so the belief is, before you become another Paul Ryan, we're going to make you remember your Tea Party roots, Speaker McCarthy. And this is the only way we can hold you responsible. Again, I don't believe that that's the position of all of the members of the caucus. I believe it is of the Chip Roys. I believe that the Lauren Boberts and Matt Gaetz are in it for themselves. So and I think that's what that is.
I'm trying to figure out whether or not he's going to go further than. Like, how many more concessions can he be expected to make? Because at a certain point, I know they're trying to get rid of, like, limitations on controlling people's ability to speak during the debate. Yes. And McCarthy is threatening now to possibly even switch over to a plurality vote,
which
would really open the door for potential chaos, where you could have more Republicans in Congress, but the Democrats even end up as Speaker of the House if something goes fire.
Well, the I t- to be very honest with you, I don't think that that particular issue is the major sticking point. If I had to put my, if I had to put a guess as to what is the major holdout, it is over the establishment of rules around the budget. Right now, it requires, I believe it requires someone to second the motion to actually debate an amendment to these omnibus bills and to these large spending bills. And they want that rule to be abolished. I mean, remember that the House, much like the Senate, is a maze of Byzantine rules, many of which go back, you know, go back to the inception of that body. The problem is that Tea Party members are saying that Democrats have become adept at manipulating them. We need to get rid of them. But here's the other thing they're saying, and you heard this from Dan Bishop. Dan Bishop says it wasn't just Speaker Pelosi who was good at manipulating them. Paul Ryan was as well. Mm-hmm. So what he's maintaining is that there is, and you've heard this term in certainly in the past 3 to 4 years, you even heard former President Trump use the term, that there is a uniparty.
Yep.
That there is an establishment, right? That there is a cabal of Democrats and Republicans who want to maintain the status quo. And the Chip Roys, the Rand Pauls, these are the individuals who are saying enough. The omnibus bill, I think it just set it off.
With the fiscal deadline coming up,
mm-hmm.
I mean, this could become an absolutely chaotic thing for the entire country soon, where, you know, you could have government shutdown go on for a very long time, especially if a lot of the Republicans aren't on the same page about it. And the Democrats probably won't be. You might find a couple, like I know Mikey Sherrill in our mm-hmm. state would be more willing to play ball, but like a lot of them are just not going to do it. I'm also, I'm a little confused as to why McConnell has not caught any opposition from his party.
Because there aren't enough Republican senators in that Freedom Caucus mold. There aren't enough of them.
It's just like Rand Paul, really.
Yeah, look, it. I mean, you have a couple. You certainly have Rand Paul, but remember, if you take a look at the average age of the Freedom Caucus, the average age of the Freedom Caucus members are in the 40s to 50s. The average age of senators on the Republican side are well into the 70s, 60s and 70s.
Wow.
It is a completely different mindset. Many of them are also beholden to Mitch McConnell because if they never understood the power that he wielded, they understood it well in 2022. He did not want Kelly Chewbacca in Alaska. She did not get there. He did not want, he didn't want specific people in Arizona and in Nevada, Adam Laxalt. He didn't want Mehmet Oz in the end. All of the people he didn't want, he starved their campaigns. And it is to maintain what he believes is a sense of sanity. It's the reason why he's looking at everything that's happening over there and very thankful. I truly believe that Mitch McConnell is much happier being in the minority with his group of senators supporting him than to have had a majority where it would have been that same sort of cadre. Rand Paul is not enough to rock the boat. And that's the difference. McConnell hangs on by virtue of the fact that everyone there is just simply stayed and completely fine with the status quo, as sad as it might seem. A number of them are going to pay for that, but for right now, they're good.
It's really quite fascinating where we are in politics, because on my side of the aisle, we've got like a pretty clear two divisions on mm-hmm. the left and the farther left in the Democratic Party. But the right wing, everyone's kind of like a different kind of right wing, you know? You mm-hmm. have a who are, some make authoritarian musings, some are mm-hmm. very, very small government, some care very much about the budget, more mm-hmm. about others, more about social issues. I mean, you know, you bring Dan Crenshaw into a group of Republicans, and you don't really know what kind of reaction they're going to give him, because
it's not a good one right now. Let's just say I've brought up his name amongst Republicans, particularly, you know, my students who are Republicans. He doesn't have a good name right now. And frankly, I'm certainly not a Republican, but I can tell you this, if he ever thought about running for president, that would be an instance where I would jump in. I would switch allegiance back to Democrats to vote for whoever was opposing him. He is a neocon Bush Republican, and his stalwart support of Ukraine to the point of calling everyone who opposed it, and I'm one of the people who opposes our continued intervention there, has been abominable. It echoes the same Bush statements, but of course, the reality is that the Republican Party has always been a big tent party. The difference is that after George W. Bush, you saw the decentralization of the Republican Party because you saw the ending of the dynasties in the GOP. And none of that mattered any longer. And with that decentralization, you're going to have a come up. The saddest part about it is that on the Democratic side, I said to my progressive students in the past 48 hours, say what you will about the Freedom Caucus and what they're doing, but when it came right down to it, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez didn't get a third of what she was asking for, yet she voted for Speaker Pelosi. Mm-hmm. Imagine what it would have been if she and Ayanna Pressley and can't recall the representative from Minnesota that also makes up the squad, and as well as Michigan, Ilhan Omar, and imagine if the four of them had stuck together and brought in a number of other progressives like Ro Khanna and the like, what would have happened? Representative Jaipal, I think you would have gotten far greater on the progressive side. And to be sure, I hope that Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries is paying attention, because he is not Speaker Pelosi. And I have every reason to believe that an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is looking at this with great interest, because if these Republicans can extract this from a Kevin McCarthy and walk away from it being lauded as heroes in their party, you better believe that they will try something to similar effect in the future, which, by the way, I would love. I love it, what's happening now on the Republican side. I would love it on the Democratic side. I am a fan of disruptive politics because it yields necessary change. That's what's happening here, and I love it.
Amen to that.
Yeah.
I think that's what it's about, you know. I think a lot of people get very comfortable with the idea of I guess stability, and there's times for that. There's times where that's necessary in politics. Mm-hmm. But you want to see people stand for something and be passionate and disagree about things, even among people who have similar general beliefs.
Absolutely. But there's a difference between consistency and inertia. And I think that's the problem for a Speaker McCarthy. He just happened to be in the barrel at the time when that particular faction of the Republican Party just said enough. I think that's the primary issue right now for him, is that he's there, but not that these are not shared issues. But I think we are looking at this and calling it chaotic. But just remember, the conservative party in Israel had to cobble together a coalition in order to govern under Prime Minister Netanyahu. Before that, Prime Minister Boris Johnson steps down. And what do they have to do? They have to promise Nigel Farage's party a seat at the table in order to form the coalition government. Everywhere else in the world, these are parliamentary politics. If you want to govern, you're going to have to placate all of the members. Mm-hmm. And so for the rest of the world, they're looking at this and going, well, what's wrong with this? It's only here that we go, oh, this is chaos. And this is, no, this is how the process is supposed to work. This is the sausage that we tell people you don't want to see made, but you actually love it when it is. It's delicious. But you don't want to see it getting ground up, but that's what's happening right now. And folks just need to chill out. It's going to work out.
You got to wonder, though, like, you know, I've gained a lot of respect for Pelosi towards the end of this simply because, you know, you look and you see people like McCarthy and Pelosi and Schumer who have been in power for a very long time. And I think there are definitely issues that come with that. Mm-hmm. It means that they have certain level of institutional understanding, mm-hmm. that allows you to actually steer the Ayanna Pressleys or steer the Rand Pauls and steer the Elise Stefanics of the world. And, mm-hmm. you know, these are people with big personalities who mm-hmm. are often disruptors, and getting them to fall in line and to actually walk towards one point is really, really hard to do.
It is, but it counts when you control the purse strings. I mean, how many times did we see in the Arizona race the Blake Masters talk about the fact, complain that he's being outspent, Mark Kelly is outspending him. Well, that was in response to his comment that if he made it into the Senate, he was going to definitely oppose Mitch McConnell. Well, why would you say that out loud about the man who is controlling the flow of money there? Kelly Shabaka says the same thing in Alaska. Why would you say that out loud when you know, there's something to be said about understanding. Nancy Pelosi was a prolific fundraiser. Kevin McCarthy is a prolific fundraiser. Chuck Schumer, not so much. But certainly before him, Harry Reid, a prolific fundraiser. Yep. If these are the people who control the money, you see? That's all you need to keep an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in line.
If you can pump a bunch of money into their, I mean, AOC, I think, is safe because she knows that district so well, but she can't run for Senate.
No, that wouldn't be. But even in her district, she should never consider herself safe, because I know people in that district as well. And she is gaining a reputation of becoming cozier with the establishment. Look, wealth changes things. You know, she came into Congress touting the fact that she had student debt out the wazoo. That student debt was cleared up before half of her first term was over. And now she's making a significant grip of money. I'm sure she's probably a millionaire at this point. That changes things. If nothing else, it changes the perception of her, which it is. So no one is safe. Remember, Eric Cantor learned that the hard way. It's the reason why he wasn't speaker, because he believed he was safe. In our home state, I'm sure Mr. Sweeney thought he was safe as well.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
And so you become complacent. Nobody is safe. And that's how it should be. You should have to fight and contend for every vote. It should never be so consistent that you just walk into that position. But they own it. I am loving seeing this. There are people who go, this is a clown show, this is horrible. No, this is how it was always supposed to be. When I teach the history of American government, it was never, I mean, for crying out, during the entire Civil War, you had Southerners who were beating, you had a Southerner who beat a Democrat near to death on the floor of the House.
Mm-hmm.
And yet today we're concerned because folks are, it's a 10th ballot, an 11th ballot. That's what, okay. Believe me, you don't want what it used to be.
I mean, even the early speaker votes in like the early 1900s, there was chaos. There were constantly revolts against the speaker. And the first one, I think it was like, what was it, Cannon, I think?
Yeah. It was
ruthless because he had to be. And that's what Congress normally looks like. Over the last few decades, it's become a lot more orderly. And then even still, when Gingrich even saw this problem himself. Like he came up in a revolution and he went down in a revolution.
Absolutely. And it was, you know, again, and I remember it very well, Newt Gingrich and his contract with America and so forth and so on. The point is, I am not concerned about where Republicans will be at the end of this fight. I'm concerned about where, what the state of legislation will be, the state of investigations, oversight, all of those things on the other side of it. What are these concessions from McCarthy going to change the House to look like after it's all done? That's what I'm less sure about.
Joe Leo Carney Warden, Rutgers political science and law professor, and Toby Amatoso, former Rutgers Democrats member. Thank you both so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Joey. I always appreciate it.
An absolute joy and pleasure speaking with you, Professor.
You as well, sir. I appreciate you.
All right, well, that about wraps it up for me this week. Thank you so much for joining me, as always. To stay in touch with what's going on in the show, all you have to do is follow me on social media, which you can do on Twitter, @block_Joey. Again, my last name is spelled B-L-O-C-H _Joey. You can also check me out on Instagram, @joey.block.39. Again, that is @joey.block.39. Now, if you just found this show for the first time, you're like, oh my God, this is so great. I love the show. But where do I find it? Well, this is what you have to do. You have to go to your browser. You got to type in FoxSportsRadioNewJersey.com. Again, that is FoxSportsRadioNewJersey.com/podcasts. That'll take you directly to the podcast page where all the podcasts are. You scroll down till you find In the Middle with Joey Block. You click on that, and all the episodes will be there, with the newest one at the top and the older ones at the bottom. And we typically put them out every Friday afternoon around 2 or 3 o'clock, so you can expect something around then for sure. Well, thank you so much for joining me. It has been a pleasure. We're back again next week with more In the Middle right here on Fox Sports New Jersey.